Check out my newly renamed podcast, Democracy on Fire with Kay Brown, where we'll discuss the ongoing conflict with Iran and its implications for our economy, security, and upcoming elections. Hope to see you there. Democracy on Fire on United America Network.
Welcome to Hotspots on the United America Network. From the shifting landscapes of politics and culture to the urgent challenges facing our planet and our communities, this is where the conversations that matter most come alive. With her experience as a journalist, legislator, and activist, Kay Brown brings sharp insight, uplifting perspective, and unflinching courage to the issues shaping our future. Get ready for candid conversations, bold ideas, and the pushback our times demand. Now, here's Kay.
Hello. Welcome to Hotspots. So glad you are here. I'm so pleased to welcome my guest today, Robert Hubbell, author of today's edition newsletter. Robert is a retired lawyer and one of the most dynamic voices on the scene today. He's unpacking our situation with clarity, insight, and providing hope and direction for what's next. Thanks for being here, Robert.
Good afternoon, Kay. It's an honor to be here.
Robert is a retired lawyer, worked for more than 40 years for global law firms on a whole series of different topics. He's a husband, father, and grandfather. He and his wife, Jill, are my touchstones. And today's edition is my main go-to for analysis beyond what you read in the legacy media. I so appreciate his thoughtful, inspiring, and calming perspective. We can do this, and here's how. As we record this episode, the unfolding political debacle continues to spiral. War chaos, corruption, and cruelty to contend with, but there is hope. Momentum is building. More people and organizations are awakening to this catastrophe and mobilizing for action, understanding that we, the people, do have the power if we stand strong, stand together, and do not give up. So really, thank you, Robert, again, for helping to carry that message forward and keeping people on an even keel in these difficult times. When and why did you start today's edition newsletter?
My wife and I have three adult daughters, and in 2016, we assured those adult daughters that the adults had this, that there was no way that Hillary would lose or that Trump would win. And when he did, my daughters were devastated. And because of who Trump was, with the Access Hollywood revelations and just his predatory manner, it was difficult, I think, particularly for women to see this serial sexual predator as their president. And they had a hard time following the news in the immediate aftermath of the election. And in fact, one of our daughters really needed to be grounded. We flew out to Washington, D.C. to help stabilize her, to get her the help that she needed. And when we came back to our home in Los Angeles, we were sitting on our living room couch talking about what we could do to help our daughters who did not want to follow the news. And my wife suggested that I write them a nightly email that explained to them what was happening in a way that was hopeful yet realistic. And so I started to do that in November of 2016. I continued to do that till February of 2017, when three family friends said, you know what, we would like that daily email with your message of hope because we're having a hard time following the news and we feel anxious and afraid. And so we sent it to three family friends in February of 2017. Several months later, we had 200 people reading that nightly email. We couldn't believe that many people cared about what I had to say, but it got passed around by word of mouth. It got big enough that Google tried to squash me like a bug because I was using the BCC field to distribute a newsletter. Don't try that at home, folks. It will not end happily for you. I moved to Constant Contact, where we gained an audience of about 18,000 people. And at Constant Contact, I was paying for the privilege of sending a nightly free email. So I moved over to Substack, which is free to me with a voluntary subscription model. And also because Heather Cox Richardson was on Substack, which many of my readers also read. And so today I have about 150,000, 160,000 followers, but the message is the same, which is, this is what happened today in the news, and this is why we should remain hopeful despite the spin that the press is putting on it. And I will say, I won't bury the lead here. For me, the secret is perspective, that the thing that the onslaught of media takes away from us is the ability to calmly analyze where we are in the broader arc of American democracy and to see the trend lines that still remain positive. And if we can have that perspective, if we can maintain that professional distance, if we can lift one another up, we're going to make it through this. It's just a question of when. And I will acknowledge things are bad and they may get worse, but they are going to get better as long as we do not give up, as long as we do not surrender. We the people, we give the consent of the governed, and we can take that back. And frankly, I think we are in the process of doing so.
What do you see as the most effective and important tactics for people who are wanting to do something? People always say, what can we do? What can I do? Feeling, oh, there's nothing that we can really do except vote. Of course, that's crucial and important. But what tactics are working around the country?
I think the most important thing that everyone can do is to join a community of other people who are active. And it's important for a couple of reasons. One, you increase your effectiveness and your impact. You learn from people who may have been doing this for 8 years and are quite sophisticated now about how they're proceeding. But more importantly, you lift one another up. There are days when we all know the news is very difficult to take, and the urge to look away is strong. And if you can be in a community of others who are continuing the fight, who see themselves as part of a long arc of the march towards justice and equality, you can make it through those bad days. Because the absolute worst thing that can happen is for someone to give up. That is what the MAGA extremists want. That is their plan. That is the point of the flood the zone daily developments in the news. They want people to look away. They want people to give up. Don't do it. Do not surrender. And the best way you can lift yourself up is in community with other people who are active. And it matters less what specifically you do than that you do something. There are, call it 85, 86 million, 90 million people who voted or attempted to vote against Trump. There were another 90 million people who did not vote. And you compare that to the 70 plus million who supported Trump. There are more of us than there are of them. And if we all do something, that's enough. Because together there is nothing that we cannot do.
Talk a little bit about the Election Rigging Response Reform Act, Proposition 50, and how that fits into the picture here.
Yeah, the framers never anticipated that anyone would try to rig this system the way that Republicans are. If you look at the infrastructure of the Constitution, it provides for a decennial census for the purpose of allocating electors. And they never thought that anybody would try to effectively override the census to do midterm redistricting. They envisioned this as something that would happen every 10 years. And so Trump understands he's in deep trouble. His favorability ratings are just, they're trending down. No one should give up because of that fact. No one should count on Democrats, Republicans defeating themselves. But Trump and the MAGA extremists understand that they're going to lose the House at least, and maybe the Senate, if they don't somehow cheat in the 2026 election. And so they came up with this idea that let's just skip ahead, skip over the decennial census and redistrict based on the 2024 election results, which were Trump's high watermark. Let's face it. For the first time ever, he won the popular vote. even though he did not win a majority. And so what Republicans are trying to do is to bake into the system mid-cycle those anomalies where they overperformed with independents, where they overperformed with Latinos. And so they've redrawn districts using gerrymandered state legislatures. Now, California has an independent redistricting commission to avoid gerrymandered districts. But given that the Republicans have attempted to break the system, to break the decennial census and allocation of electors system, if you take the perspective of looking at the national map, what Gavin Newsom has proposed in the California legislature is to allow the people of California, rather than a gerrymandered legislature, to allow the people of California to redistrict a certain number of districts on a temporary basis through 2030 only. And while I know a lot of people are unhappy about Prop 50 on the Democratic side because it's not the way that the system was designed to work with a redistricting commission, if you look at the broader playing field, what Prop 50 might do if it passes, if that's what the people want in California, is it will level the playing field. And that's all it does. Unlike what's happening in Texas, California is simply making more districts competitive. There's no assurance that any Democrat or, frankly, any Republican is going to win any district in California. They still have to go out and compete for the votes. So I wholeheartedly support Prop 50. It is a response to rigging that is happening not only in Texas, but in several Republican-controlled states in a way that is contrary to the very structure of the Constitution.
So we have a special election going on right now, and mail ballots are dropping at homes and residences across California. And to take part in this, it's pretty simple to vote by mail, vote from home at your convenience, and vote early and get those ballots in. I'm very hopeful that we will have a successful election and adopt Proposition 15 to push back and to give us a fighting chance of getting control of the Congress so that we have a check on Trump, which we desperately to bring in his lawlessness. A lot of the things that are going on, it would make a big difference in the dynamic we're experiencing if even one house of Congress were willing to stand up to him.
And we're on the same page in that, but I think all indications are that the election will be close. And if anyone is hearing this podcast and wondering, what can I do? The most important thing that organizers say they need are people to make calls, to volunteer for phone banks, especially in Spanish speakers, and also people who are willing to knock on doors and do literature drops at homes. The other side has a lot of money because of one person, Charlie Munger Jr., and they are blanketing the voters with glossy mailers. I don't know about their phone operation, but I can tell you that phone banks are highly effective, and I know that the Democratic Party and activist organizations are desperate for more people to man the phones. So go to Mobilize US or to whichever other activist group you belong that is running a phone bank and volunteer. And you know what? If you haven't phone banked, it's scary until you make the first call. And then it's just making phone calls and talking to people.
Very important. Please do that. Robert, I've heard you talk several times about the importance of reforming the United States Supreme Court. The situation that we're looking at right now is the lower courts are effectively holding Trump accountable for the most part and are providing that bulwark, upholding our Constitution and the rule of law. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court is not doing so. And you've alluded to the need to bring about reform. What does that look like and how would that actually happen?
Sure. So let me just say that we have a gerrymandered Supreme Court. It was fixed by failing to appoint Merrick Garland at the appropriate time. That effectively swapped two seats. But then the reactionary majority on the court has just abandoned the rule of law. They're no longer going through the pretense of following the law. They are overturning lower court decisions without any explanation whatsoever. They're violating their shadow docket. They are overturning long established precedent at a frightening rate. And yet these people claim that they're originalists until the Constitution says something they don't like, and then they just interpret it however they want. Now, there are a lot of very good ideas for reforming the Supreme Court, but I think it's vitally important that we distinguish between those ideas that require a constitutional amendment, which would be two-thirds passage in both chambers of Congress, and ratification by three-fourths of the states, or 38 states. The likelihood of passing an amendment to reform the Supreme Court, a constitutional amendment, it approaches zero. Now, there is one reform that we can engage in, which only requires a majority vote in both houses of Congress and the signature of the president, and that is to enlarge the Supreme Court. The size of the court is set by legislation. It is subject to the filibuster, but the filibuster can be overridden by 51 votes. So realistically, we can enlarge the Supreme Court if we regain control of Congress and we elect a Democratic president. Now, how big should we enlarge it to make a difference? Well, it has to be big enough to overwhelm the reactionary majority. And I think the institutional reaction of people who are former Supreme Court clerks or constitutional law professors, God bless them all for their service and for what they're doing. But I think we have to be bolder than that. And let me just give you a little bit of perspective. When the Constitution was passed in 1789 and the Supreme Court was first established, we had 4 million people in America and 6 justices. We now have, order of magnitude, 100 times more population, 100x, which I think is 1,000%, or maybe it's more. This is why I'm not a doctor. I'm not good at math. It's 100-fold. And yet the Supreme Court in 1789 was 6 justices, and they've only added 3 justices, or it's grown by 50%. Now, I'm not suggesting that we expand the Supreme Court to something like 600 justices, which I think would be the proportional size. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has 27 active justices, and it works just fine. And I think that having a much larger Supreme Court would force consensus, which is lacking in what we have now. You've got one or two justices on the Supreme Court deciding the fate of the nation, just as Justice Kennedy did for almost 15 years. He was the swing vote. We have to get away from this one or two votes telling people what liberties they have. If you have a Supreme Court of 27, you are going to have to build coalitions around what the law means rather than what two or three people can get away with. Now, whenever I propose that, people say, won't Republicans just do the same thing? To which I respond, if we decide what we should do, how we should act based on what Republicans might do, we will never do anything. So set that aside. Moreover, let them. They will need to control both chambers of Congress and have a president who will sign the legislation. And frankly, I think once we take back control of Congress, it will be decades before Republicans are back in control with the trifecta, which is why they're doing their worst now. So if it were up to me, I would expand the Supreme Court substantially and simply have a list of illegitimate decisions to be reversed. Citizens United, Trump v. U.S., Dobbs versus Women's Health, I've forgotten the name there, but Dobbs, Shelby County versus Holder. You could reverse 4 or 5 decisions and regain huge segments of the progress that was made during the 60s and 70s and 80s in terms of civil rights and women's rights and personal liberties. And we also need to protect Obergefell, which is within the sights of the reactionary majority. They are coming for same-sex marriage. So all we have to do is expand the Supreme Court significantly enough to make it very difficult for Republicans ever to be able to do the same thing. And I think we will be a long way down the road to reclaiming democracy.
Robert, a lot of people are disillusioned with political parties and want to just say the whole structure is flawed, it's not working, there's no vision, there's no difference, the influence of money has corrupted everything. And that's led me to think a lot about what are we going to do when we're in charge, and where's that core message, vision of how things can be better for people that Democrats need to be developing and coalescing around. And it seems like we're not quite there. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that in your own vision of what would you like to see happen when we're back in charge, the important things that we need to fix and be focusing on in order to engage and inspire people.
I think overturning Citizens United will go a long way to reopening the Democratic Party to what it should be. But I will say this, I understand people's dissatisfaction, unhappiness with the Democratic Party. But when people use the phrase Democratic Party, what they almost always mean are one or two or three people, the Democratic leaders in Congress and maybe the president. The Democratic Party is you and me. And the problem with the Democratic Party is they don't want it to be you and me. And that's not a knock on the Democratic Party. That's the knock on every organization. The leadership wants to control the members. But beginning in 2016 and 2017, the real Democratic Party began to emerge and to show its face. And it was the grassroots activists who met in living rooms and who are now standing on street corners and overpasses, who are writing in organized fashion to corporations and to political leaders. And I will say we're not at a point yet where the Democratic Party leadership is comfortable with the grassroots movement that has really become the Democratic Party. Every Sunday or every Saturday, there are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Democrats who are out engaging in retail activism. And yet you never hear the party leadership talk about that. You don't see the party leaders out there on the street corners and the overpasses. You don't see them thanking the grassroots. They use the grassroots to raise money, but they don't really provide support. So what I would like to see is for the grassroots activists to have a seat at the table. And just to be clear about vocabulary, I'm not using grassroots activists as code for progressives or moderates or anyone else. The people who are willing to go out and defend democracy in the streets in a peaceful manner deserve to be the people determining the policies of the Democratic Party, rather than people who are only worried about being reelected and having those reelection desires funded by large corporations and wealthy donors. We need to get away from that. We need to overrule or reverse Citizens United and essentially let the Democratic Party become a populist party again.
That is something we can certainly strive for, and I'm with you on that. And I'm a longtime party person, but I believe in the power of the grassroots and the power of the people. And as you've so eloquently expressed both today and on your podcast and in your writing, we can do this. We are doing it. Success is not guaranteed, but we do have the capacity and the tools that we need to prevail. It's a long-haul project that takes a lot of energy and focus and coordination and determination. If we all do a little, it'll add up to a lot. On United American Network, we're working to build the movement to get us out of this through awareness that leads to action. And we hope you'll join that movement with us on United American Network.
I want to thank Robert Hubbell, my guest today, for being with us and for all you're doing and continue to do to lead us in a calm and inspiring manner. Thanks for being with us on Hot Spots. This is what democracy sounds and looks like.
Thank you, Kay. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Hot Spots with Kay Brown, where tough issues meet thoughtful conversation. Stay engaged, stay inspired, and join us again as we spotlight the struggles, solutions, and stories that fuel resilience and change. Until next time, keep your fire burning. Hot Spots is a production of the United America Network and is available on most major podcast platforms, as well as from unitedamericanetwork.com. This is what democracy sounds and looks like.
If you've had enough and want to wake up our recalcitrant Congress, join me on Democracy on Fire with Kay Brown for the top 23 reasons we need regime change now. Hope to see you there, Democracy on Fire on United America Network.